Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Basic Bitch Health Show. Today, we're back with Brady for round two. It's a little bit longer than last time, so we're able to dig into some things a bit more. Some of the things we cover include reading food labels and the GRAS status, his background and how he curates the information that he takes in, the old school food pyramid and Canada's new food plate guidelines, as well as a bit on nutrients, the micro, the macro, and nutrient-dense foods. I've added some links in the description of things that we talk about, so be sure to check those out and dig into them more. And that's about it. So thanks for listening, and I hope you enjoy the episode.
Bray, welcome back to the podcast.
Oh, thank you. It was fun the first time.
Yeah, we did a little teaser there.
New for me.
Yeah. Yeah, you've never done anything, never chatted on mics?
No. I did the one course that we were talking about for the Canadian School of Natural Nutrition and just on vitamins and minerals, which was like a three-hour lecture that we put together for them. But that's the extent of my public speaking for the most part, beyond, you know, just talking to people every day in the store and stuff.
Right. So who is that for? The Canadian?
It's the program that is offered to become a holistic nutritionist. If you've ever seen that designation from practitioners. And so they needed somebody to talk about supplements and just what you're looking for and how to read labels and, you know, they're covering the sort of, you know, coaching aspect of it and the food and the, you know, advising aspect of it, but they needed someone to sort of, you know, teach some of their students what are some of the nuances that you're going to encounter when looking at supplements. And so we went through and talked about vitamins and minerals and a little bit on herbals and homeopathics and so on and so forth, and what to look for, what's the nuances on the labels, and what you're going to be able to, you know, differentiate between brands and things like that.
Right. Yeah. So in the school, they're learning about how, what to use, when, and everything with supplements and holistic stuff.
Yeah.
And then you are showing them how to translate that into like the real world of commerce, of things you buy.
You know, also like, you know, if they're telling somebody, hey, I want you to go get this multivitamin, then this was a little bit of information of, hey, this is what to look for when you're recommending a multivitamin. And this is going to be what's going to differentiate different brands, or this is going to be some forms that you might, you know, find more valuable. These are going to be some of the better absorbed forms. This is going to be things that you might want to watch out for as red flags. Like, you know, some vitamins have just like a laundry list of non-medicinal ingredients with food colorings and weird emulsifiers and things like that. And so, you know, we would have examples of that. Like, hey, if you see this on the non-medicinals, those are all non-required things that are questionably egregious. And you don't have to have those in there, so why bother? And so let's look for non-medicinals that are a little bit more simple. And, you know, we don't need FD&C red dye number 6 or whatever, or blue, or, you know, in our multivitamin. That's a completely unnecessary thing. And for some people, that might cause some kind of problems for their system. And so you show them those kind of nuances.
Oh, interesting. Is that the yellow color or whatever that's like...
That one,
poison or something?
I mean, there's probably a bunch of colors that are not really safe for consumption in large amounts. You know, but the argument always would be with these kind of things is you're only putting in a little bit, and so they'll have GRAS status, which is generally regarded as safe on those things. But then, you know, you'll find some nuance there where some people have sensitivities and they'll not be able to tolerate it, or, you know, if you're getting that from a whole bunch of different sources, then all of a sudden it's not a small amount because you got it in this food product and this food product and this food product, and then you end up with this accumulation of these generally regarded as safe compounds.
Holy cow. So if you were trying to break that down, you'd have to look at, see what that, you said GRAS, generally regarded as safe.
Yes.
I never heard that before, but noticed it right away when you said it.
Yeah.
So you'd have to look at all your products and see what the GRAS of those things are and then add it up. And then you'd see actually where you're at. with what you're taking?
Potentially. Yeah. I mean, good luck finding how much is in something like that too, because it's going to be listed in the non-medicinals, which means they don't really, you know, need to tell you how much they're actually using, you know, whereas all the vitamins and minerals are going to tell you how much is in each dose. But in the non-medicinals, it's just going to be this list, you know, kind of like you find on an ingredient list of a whatever packaged food product. And in order of quantity, it's going to have the most at the beginning of the list and then the least as you go through the list. And so those are all going to be in there, but you're never going to know. Maybe if you reached out to the companies, maybe they are going to tell you, or you had some kind of analyzation done on it, maybe you could find out how much is actually going to be in there, but they're not going to be open about it on the label.
Right. Are there, without going into the long talk you did for this school, are there ones that people should generally just avoid because they do tend to be high and in many things, so they would affect?
I would have to look it up. I wouldn't be able to say off the top of my head. An awesome reference for additives and safety of different chemicals is the Environmental Working Group. So it's EWG.org. Okay. And they have a database of, you know, they're the ones that came out with the Clean 15 Dirty Dozen for produce, if you've ever seen anything like that. The Clean 15 being the least sprayed, you know, with pesticides kind of foods that maybe you don't want to, you know, don't necessarily need to buy organic. And then the Dirty Dozen is the heavily sprayed things like strawberries and soft fruit, like pears and apples and things like that. And that's going to be heavily sprayed. And you probably want to buy those things organic because they're going to be one of the more contaminated foods. And so they're trying to give you some nuance of, you don't have to buy everything organic, but, you know, you buy some. So they have things, you know, resources like that. You can look up any chemical I've ever wanted to look up, whether that's in a product or in like a body care product. They have a great, you know, website for body care called Skin Deep, where you can literally look up your individual product. You can look up whatever deodorant you use, and it'll give you an analysis of all the ingredients that are in there and then all the potential issues or that you might come across with some of those ingredients. They'll have an overall rating and everything like that. So they'd be a great reference for that if you wanted to look up, you know, what the potential nefarious effects of FD&C red number 6 is. Or whatever other compound.
So that was EWG?
EWG.
.org?
.org.
Okay. And that was, what's it stand for again?
The Environmental Working Group.
Environmental Working Group. Yep. And then Skin Deep was the other one for like...
Yeah, which is a side, you know, website that they've produced, and that is for body care specifically,
right?
Because body care is just is very unregulated and can be just loaded with nefarious ingredients.
That's like lotion, makeup,
body lotion, makeup, deodorant, soap, deodorant. Okay. You know, the makeup one is quite profound.
Yeah,
that's, you know, look it up or don't look it up. Like that's on you. You get to decide if you want to know or not.
If you're going to look it up, you're going to have to make changes. Yeah. If you care.
I mean, hard not to look at some of those ingredients and go, I want to have that, you know, on my skin or on my, in my body.
Do you remember that Batman with Jack Nicholson?
Yeah, of course.
And it was all about cosmetics, and he had, and when they put the cosmetics together, it like melted their faces.
Yes, totally. Yeah. So they had a face like him or something like that.
So is it like a minor version of that?
Yeah.
Okay. Going back to the talk you did, the 3-hour lecture thing for the school, why did they ask you? Like,
That's interesting.
What gives you the...
I think it was the person that was running the program had been visiting the store and had talked to us numerous times, felt very comfortable with our knowledge base on the products that we were talking about, reached out to my brother and Lynn, and they, you know, arranged this and kind of said, like, is this possible? And then, you know, discussed it, like, who's going to do it? And you know, they... I can't remember if I volunteered or volunteered me, something like that. And then, you know, between me and a couple other people, we worked here, we created a little, you know, mini course on different, the nuances in all the vitamins and minerals. And that's like, not to say like what these things, we're not teaching them like what each nutrient does in the body. We're teaching them what's the difference between methylated B vitamins and unmethylated B vitamins. What does that look like on a label? So we're not necessarily like, this is what vitamin B1 and B12 does in the body and all the nuances there. That's not what the course is actually about. It's actually more about what is the difference between methylcobalamin and cyanocobalamin. You're going to see both of those ingredients on different products. And so what is better? What are the nuances between the two? And what might you prioritize, or what might you put on a scale? And there's tons of different types of magnesium. And so what are we going to say is a better magnesium? Is there going to be uses for certain types over other types? And so the nuance is there more so than what these nutrients are actually doing.
So it's more like how to read the labels, what the things on the labels mean, and what the industry is, how they're using different words and labels and things like that, and how that translates to the stuff that they're learning about the vitamins or the supplements or whatever.
Yeah.
And what that looks like on a label.
Yeah.
Currently.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
So.
And also regulations too. Health Canada regulates all the supplements in Canada. So, there's nuances with what label claims are allowed to be made and what the, natural product number means and how they have to create a label, based on the guidelines that Health Canada set out. So there's that part of it as well.
Sounds like everyone should have a course like that so they can read the blay labels on things.
Right, just in general. Just for the store, general. Like have that as a school program. And maybe they have that in the school now. I don't know.
Yeah. That's pretty wild, yeah.
Yeah.
What do they say for a grocery store? Like if you go in and you can't read, if you don't know what something is, if it's not like plain, like
if you can't pronounce it, then it's probably not good for you.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean I've also heard like single ingredient foods. Go and shop single ingredient foods, which, obviously is nuanced too. Like, I don't think anybody's going to say like sauerkraut's really bad for you, but it's going to have two ingredients. It's going to have cabbage and salt.
Right.
And so, it's nuanced.
But I guess it just brings it down, right? Because if the fewer things that you don't know what they are, then probably hopefully better it is.
Yeah. I mean, that's probably a good rule. Mm-hmm. It's the same as a shop in the perimeter of the grocery store, right. All the aisles, the grocery department is probably going to have the most processed foods and you're going to have the least processed foods on the external part of that grocery store. Typically grocery stores are made like that.
Right. Well, that's perfect for what we're going to go into. But before that, I just want to, so you did this course and you work at a store. Is that what gives you the clout or the authority? That's a bit of a strong word, I guess, but
I have no authority
to do something on like this. Like what's your background in?
So most of it's self-study. Okay. So I have done, a couple smaller courses. I did the Alive Academy product advisor program, that was like, a self-study program, and they're teaching you similar kind of nuances to this kind of stuff, teaching you about, the differences between different nutrients, a small snippet of what those nutrients do in the body, basic kind of things. And then lots of self-study. I'm lucky enough to grow up in the time where we've come across podcasts and online content. And so there's just so much free information out there. And if you know where to look, then you can really become educated. And so beside reading books, listening to audio content, different podcasts and audiobooks and then reading, I was very fortunate. And when I worked at Thrifty Foods before the store ever existed, they let me do a lot of research. And so I could actually be at work and read articles and read, not necessarily books, but I could definitely read, a chapter here, in between helping customers and so on and so forth. And then you just accumulate this over time. And then eventually I got into more, coaching and food and that came a lot from Precision Nutrition. Once I came across their programs, I was like, that is the stuff I want to learn. And so Precision Nutrition launched a coaching program. And so they have a program where they train coaches. And so they want to, they also coach people. And then they were like, well, we can only help so many people ourselves, that try to build an army of these nutrition coaches that are well-trained in behavioral changes and also just basic biochemistry and digestion assimilation how to make change in the body, what you need to do and what steps that takes. And so that is sort of like the last, formal, semi-formal. Okay. Again, it's self-directed. And so that's the last training that I've done that's a little bit more formal, but I'm kind of obsessed with the topic. I love human performance and learning about, what can optimize how you feel and how you perform. And I've always been into exercise. And so it just, I can't help but learn as much as possible. And when I find a new resource, I just try to consume as much content as I can. And, you know, I might try to get in, you know, an hour of different content almost every single day.
Okay. I was going to ask about that. Like when people think about self-directed, like I've been kind of self-directed too.
Yeah.
But I think the ratio has been quite different between you and I.
Yeah.
So when you say self-directed, like, is this like you listen to a podcast and read an hour a day or no, an hour a week or like what kind of like show people kind of the depth of.
So, I mean, it depends on what it is. So like if you're doing a course, then the idea is that you're going to try to set a goal of doing a certain amount of work over a period of time, but most of them are self-directed, meaning that you can complete them in a short period of time or a long period of time. That's how you're going to fit it into your life. But, you know, with the amount of audio content that there is out there now between audiobooks and podcasts, I can, you know, I love to walk. I walk to work every single day, and I can consume easily an hour of content between my lunch break and my walking time and just, you know, general, you know, when I'm cleaning the house, I'm doing dishes, I'm usually listening to something. Yeah. And so, you know, end up accumulating a lot of hours.
So you can
information.
You can easily say that you get about 30 hours of content a month, if not more.
Yeah, probably. Probably. Yeah.
And that compounds too, because my other question is how, like you said, with our world now, like we've got the internet, we've got podcasts and all these resources and books and everything like that. How do you know what to consume? And I feel like this is a compound, right? Like the very first stuff you started with, you might look back on that and be like, totally. Maybe should have skipped that.
Yeah.
But I mean, you know, people always talk about like, oh, it was on the internet. It must be true.
Yeah.
So do you just Google something and then read the first two articles and that's it?
Not usually.
Do you use Google?
I don't use Google. I don't use Google. I know I use DuckDuckGo because all the nuances there for a different podcast.
Yeah, maybe. We'll leave that. Yeah.
That is a huge challenge. And so I have to rely on my knowledge that I've gained and my experience that I've gained previously to know if that person is giving me good information or if it's more fluff. Mm-hmm. And you can usually tell, I mean, I can tell now where someone's coming from because usually they're like quoting a research paper and I can go look up that research paper or they might have the link to that, you know, piece of research that they're talking about in show notes or if it's an audiobook in the, you know, in the references that they provide. Mm-hmm. So you can always verify what they're looking at. I also rely on, you know, over time, you kind of can create this network of people that you've developed a trust with that the information that I've heard from them is reciprocated by other people. I've looked into more depth of their information and they seem very accurate. And then what they also can correlate for someone else, I can expand that web into more and more people. And so you end up developing this sort of umbrella of people that you find as really good references. And then you don't necessarily need to look at every single detail that they're, you know, referencing. You can rely on their information a little bit more because you've kind of vetted it either through other people or through investigating what they're saying.
Right.
Usually when I'm hearing something from multiple different sources that are not tied together, I'm pretty confident with what they're saying. And, you know, Chris Kresser has this awesome little idea about how to differentiate information, good information, that I really stuck with me. And his idea is that when something has to find if something is pretty legitimate, he likes to have three tiers. He likes to have the historical reference for it. Is there any historical use, especially with food and diet? It's very hard to research this stuff, so we have to find ways. So is there a historical use of it? Is there a historical norm of consuming it? Is there any, tradition to that consumption of that or usage of that compound? So that's one tier. Is there any peer-reviewed, published research on that compound food idea? So on and so forth. Is it that can show some efficacy, of course, but things are hard to study. It's, and there's mm-hmm. money involved in there. So not everything can have peer reviewed. And then is there an anecdote? You know, do you get people that are constantly saying, oh man, this really worked well for me. This change really helped me. This compound really helped me. If you keep hearing that over and over again, it's not like a you know, published study, but there's something to that. And so he likes to have at least 2 out of 3 mm. of those 3 pillars to really find something to be potentially efficacious. And so if you can get all 3, great. Right. You probably got something really good there. If you only get 1 of those things, like you're only getting anecdote, it's a little challenging to be like, well, a lot of people say this is good, but mm. you know, there's no research to support it. It's kind of new, or there's no historical, you know, tradition of it. So maybe not so much. Or if there's just research on something, but it's never been, there's no traditional culture that ever did this practice or so on and so forth. And there's nobody saying that it's a good idea or that they're getting a good effect of it. There's research for it, but I'm not sure. It doesn't hit, you know, I got to look into that further, maybe right. experiment with that a little bit more. But also the same goes with the traditional practice of such and such or consumption of a thing. There's only that, but they don't have the other 2. Then it's really hard to just be like, yeah, that's true. We can't just say because somebody did it in the past that it's going to be valuable. You know, right. There's a lot of things that have been consumed in the past that were not a good idea. And so we need more than just 1 out of those 3. We need 2 out of those 3 or ideally 3 out of those 3.
So when he's researching something, he tries to figure out what he's taking in, if it has at least 2 of those 3. And if it doesn't, that's, he's not saying it's BS. He's just saying, I'm going to look into it more.
Yeah, I can't be super confident in its efficacious.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. So in a sense, before you start sharing it with other people and being like, I really think this, you might want to dig in a bit more and find out about if there's any other pillar mm-hmm. for it. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Cool.
Yeah. And you know, just over time, you can tell when people are kind of, you know, out to lunch.
Yeah.
And it usually means that they're not giving you... They're not speaking in a way that gives you the where they're getting their information from. They're just saying this is true.
Right.
And that is generally a red flag. If you're just saying like, it's because of this, then you're like, but like, where did you get that from? I want to know some steps here. And when you listen to somebody that has a really good base of knowledge, they'll start quoting where they get this research, this idea from this research paper, or from talking to this person, or from visiting this region, or, you know, they'll tell you the story behind the information almost, which can give you a little bit more nuance about where they're coming from. Mm-hmm. And it's not just, I said this, and so it's, you know, it's right.
Right, right. Yeah. Well, with that, when people are going out to lunch, what should they eat? So last time we talked, you said, I'm going to quote you on this. So you're just going to love this.
Excellent.
You said, I mentioned the pyramid, food pyramid, and the 4 food groups. So this is kind of going back to like someone's just saying this is it. But also we've trusted these people, or we used to trust these people, that they have researched and this is right. But I mentioned how the pyramid's crumbling and you said some of the most ridiculous recommendations out there. So
yeah,
tell me about that. And I showed you before we started I pulled up a few of the images.
Well, and it's really interesting, you know, like you showed me the new one and it actually isn't that bad. You know, I see that. You only see a large amount of fruits and vegetables. You don't see... One of my big issues with the food pyramid is their overemphasis of grains as being the most important food.
Okay.
And where I struggle with that is when we look at nutrient density, they are one of the least nutrient dense foods. And I'm talking about vitamins and minerals and micronutrients. And so when you're prioritizing the least nutrient dense food, then you're missing out on potential micronutrients. You're filling your plate with a food with filler that isn't going to give you the micronutrients that some other foods would. And so when I see something where the base of the food pyramid is, you know, even if it's whole grains, even whole grains are not going to stand up to fruits and vegetables and nuts and seeds and organ meats on a nutrient density scale. And so why are we making that our our most, you know, servings we should consume, our base of the pyramid, our mm-hmm. our priorities when we're designing our plate. And then you brought up and the newest version of it. Obviously, somebody's trying to address this problem, and you know what do they show? They show, you know, more fruits and vegetables. They show a smaller portion of grains, and then they show, you know, their sort of quarter portion of meats and dairy and fatty foods and all that. And that's a step in the right direction. You know, most people probably would do pretty good with that.
Okay.
You know, no processed foods. Like, there's not really any processed foods. You can see images of some old, and maybe it's not in Canada, but some old maybe in the US, and they have processed foods literally on the food guide.
Like, and what? Like cereals you mentioned?
Like cereals. You might see like, cereals would be the worst one probably, but you know,
Cocoa Puffs.
Cocoa Puffs. I mean, Tufts University thinks that Cheerios are pretty good, but
there's no sugar in Cheerios.
There's no sugar. It's all whole grains. But it's obviously a move in the right direction, where they're prioritizing fruits and vegetables, and they're, you know, probably not as much protein as I would like to see. I think people do really good when they eat a lot of protein, in my experience, both on a satiety aspect of it. But the bigger thing is I don't want to see processed foods on the Canada food. I don't want to see croissants and baguettes, where we could be eating, you know, better foods like fruits and vegetables and, you know, meat, dairy, poultry, all that kind of stuff.
Okay, so like on this other pyramid, I don't know when this is from, but it had on the bottom, eat most grains and cereals, eat more fruit and vegetables, eat moderately meat, poultry, fish, eggs, dry beans. And should we eat dry beans?
I would definitely not eat dry beans. I would definitely cook those beans.
Yeah.
You know, you're definitely, you could kill yourself with some kidney beans, raw kidney really? Beans. I'm pretty sure
seriously?
You can. Yeah.
And eat less oils and fats and salts and sweets. So this one's just upside down.
Well, it's interesting that they put salts and sweets together, which is kind of funny. But yeah, I mean, you know, as far as I'm concerned, you cut out that whole bottom part of the pyramid and you actually probably have a pretty good diet. You know, fruits and vegetables, meat, poultry, dairy, you know, and then, well, I mean, the top of the one is the fats, oils, salts, mm-hmm. and sweets. You know, maybe we don't eat the sweets, but that's doing pretty good, you know, and that's more me coming from a place of looking at nutrient density. That's the micronutrients in foods and prioritizing those. If we designed a food pyramid on the foods that have the most micronutrients, which is what are we eating food for? We're eating for micronutrients mm-hmm. and for the macronutrients, the protein, carbohydrates, and fat. If we were prioritizing that, we'd be prioritizing fruits, green leafy vegetables, organ meats, nuts and seeds, animal foods, dairy products, eggs, and grains would be at the kind of bottom of the list. And so if we just focused on micronutrient content of foods, then it looks really good.
So, yeah, like I don't want to get into the why these were made this way back in the day too much, but it makes me think of my dad, and he grew up, well, both my mom and dad grew up on a farm, right? And he always had bread with every meal, a couple of slices of bread. We always had potatoes. We always had rice. Like, it was like that was the filler because they grew up very thrifty, right? So they're trying to get the things that will fill you but aren't that expensive.
Yeah.
So is that part of the reason why this may have ended up that way, or...
I mean, you can only assume. Mm-hmm. Like, there's a lot of ideas out there of how these things get, you know, made. Yeah. A lot of it can be that there's industry
corporate
involved, you know, especially, yeah, agricultural industry and processed food industry that's involved in making these things.
Right.
And so, you know, some of the most profitable foods are going to be processed grains. You know, processed foods in general, sweets and candy bars, but also processed grains like cereals and cookies and crackers and all that stuff. That's the, you know, if you want to eat whole greens and you want to, you know, get, you know, we had a naturopath come and do a talk here one time, and she was like, I totally agree. If you want to eat bread, please have bread. I want you to go buy the grains. I want you to grind the grains. Then I want you to take your water and your flour that you just made and your salt, and I want you to make a sourdough. I want you to let that sit for, you know, 12 hours or 24 hours for it to ferment. And then I want you to bake it in the oven. And I want you to do that every time you want to have bread. And so like, if you want to do that, that is probably closer to what people would have done on the farms, more so than what we're doing now. You know, because you can find sourdough in a grocery store, but it's not really sourdough. They're adding sour ingredients in it to create the taste of sour, but it hasn't been a fermented product. They're not taking that you know, original culture and then fermenting this sourdough bread from it, letting it sit and that culture digest and assimilate some of the nutrients and liberate some of the compounds that are protected by that grain to make it so you can't absorb it. And so it becomes a more nutritious food. The protein content goes up, the vitamins and mineral content goes up by fermenting it, but it takes time. So in this, you know, world that we live in now, time is cost money, and so you know you only have like the small scale bakeries that do that stuff, like Fry's Bakery. They do a wonderful proper sourdough, and that's great. And if you want to have that, you know, probably as long as you don't have any issues with you know, dairy and gluten, and then you're probably fine. And
that's really interesting. That product.
But that's there's a difference between that and, you know, what you're finding on the grocery store shelves.
Yeah. Yeah, have some bread. Oh, like I can go buy three loaves and just mow down.
Yeah, don't even have to slice it. Yeah. Don't even have to slice it.
Yeah, don't have to do any work. That's a very interesting concept, yeah. So basically your gripe, I guess, with all... And it goes similar to a podcast I just saw that I put in my playlist, but I haven't listened to it yet. And it said, stop counting calories, count nutrients.
Nice.
And it goes like that. So... It's not, and I asked you about oatmeal before, and you're like, it's not that it's bad, it's just there's not a lot of great stuff in it. Mm-hmm. And then if you fill up on it or up on things that are empty, then you won't eat, you'll be full. So you won't be eating, it takes away from eating the other things. So in a sense, it's stealing those nutrients because you're just not consuming them.
One, and the other nuance too is some people have the idea that there's this connection with the brain and the gut where you ingest some food and it doesn't have the nutrient density, it doesn't have the vitamins and minerals that you are supposed to be getting. And so you eat this food and then you're still hungry because you haven't got those vitamins. The body's like, oh, you ate that, but I'm still missing out on these essential nutrients. And so then it's like, well, now I need to go find something else to eat. Not too long after. So maybe you have oatmeal and then you're hungry again in an hour or two, and then you got to find something else. And I don't think it's hard science that that's what's going on. There's probably some other nuances there, but that is something that's important. And when you fill yourself up on high nutrient dense food, you know, good luck overeating liver. I don't think anybody's going to sit down and be like, man, I just can't stop eating liver after, you know, a pound of eating liver or something like that, right? Yeah. And same with a salad. Like, you're not, good luck overeating leafy green vegetables.
Right.
Like, that's probably not going to happen for most people unless they're, like, processing it. Now, you can throw that into a green smoothie, and now that's processed for you, and so potentially you could overeat that. But very rarely you're going to eat it just from eating a salad. But... that's very satiating for you.
Right.
And one of my favorite books that I read, we talked about before, is The Dorito Effect. And he talks about the connection of the brain and the gut and how that interacts to dictate your satiety signals and how you are interacting with that food. Your brain detects whether there's nutrients there or not. And that can change how your hunger signals interacting with your brain, and you know, whether you're going to be still hungry looking for more food or where you're going to be satiated. And of course, there's more in that book than that. Same with Rob Wolf's Wired to Eat. Same kind of idea where we're wired to find calorie-rich food, but when we have calorie-rich food without the micronutrients, then we're constantly looking for calorie-rich food because never in history were we able to figure out that there was this food without very much nutrients in it. It was always going to be high nutrient dense food because that's how our food grows.
So
without
processing. So if people don't know that is what's happening in their body, they just think they're hungry again. And if they don't know that they should be eating something more nutrient dense, and they just eat more of what they usually eat, then that's, they're just consuming more stuff that's not great for them.
Potentially.
And can more, go down
and,
a...
And more stuff with very little nutrients in it. So then you have to consume exponentially more.
Right.
To, you know, so then your calorie load goes significantly higher to get the same amount of nutrients as if you ate much higher nutrient dense food, and then the caloric content is actually quite a bit less.
And then we get into weight stuff.
And then you get into weight stuff, which is a theory with obesity, is that people are overfed and undernourished. And so we have tons of calories. We've solved the calorie, the human calorie problem. We have no problem in the Western world finding calories. Well, we have a hard time now finding is micronutrients.
Right.
And so we have a lot of deficiencies in our population, but we're not, very few people are not getting enough calories.
That's amazing. So, and also what you said, I feel like, especially in our culture here, everything's on the go. There's always something you can grab on the go. There's a corner store everywhere. There's, you can get coffee and donuts and submarines at a gas station.
Yeah.
You know, like you can get everything anywhere.
Drive through. Don't have enough to get it.
Yeah. So if you don't take the time, when you've set aside time, if you do, sometimes stuff's on the run.
Yeah.
But if you don't set a time, like this is breakfast, I'm going to have the nutrient dense stuff here. Then if you have that oatmeal and an hour later you're hungry again, it's very easy to stop and just grab something that's not healthy and not going to give you that either. Mm-hmm. It might have a bunch of things that actually aren't just not nutrient dense, but also just not good for you.
Yeah.
So then you're double screwing yourself. Like, right?
Well,
like,
and that probably perpetuates because, you know, then most likely you're going to be in that same boat in an hour or two again.
So then people are just grabbing stuff over and over instead of just taking care of that one moment that could carry them through properly and in a better way.
Yeah. And that's where you get some people that are trying to prioritize breakfast. You know, breakfast is the most important day, you know, meal of the day. And you know, for some people, maybe it's not, but that can also set you up for the day. And so you have this high nutrient dense breakfast, and then that changes how your satiety hormone, you know, satiety signaling gets affected, and your fullness cues, and then also gives you micronutrients, which is going to help with your energy levels and your cognition, and so that compounds as well. And then all of a sudden,
you can make better decisions.
You make better decisions
on those things. You can go into the gas station and go, no, I'm not going to have that.
Yeah, I don't need that, actually.
I don't need it.
Yeah.
In an hour, I'm going to go home and I'm going to have some real food.
Yeah. Yeah. I can wait the hour because I'm, you know, hopefully metabolically flexible and I've had enough nutrients to get me through to my next meal. You know, you find people that eat high nutrient dense foods that, you know, might only eat twice a day. But they eat a lot, but, you know, they eat twice a day. And that might not be optimal for everybody, but it goes to show you that there's so much flux in there. I mean, there's people that do the one meal a day as well, which I don't know how you do that because that's a lot of food in one sitting. But nonetheless, you can get away with it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Huh. Okay. There's so many roads we could go down. You said there's two phrases. You said satiety signaling.
Yeah.
And hunger hormone. What was that next one? Started with an H.
What would it be? It would be like
hunger signaling?
Like hunger hormones.
Hunger hormones.
Yeah.
So what are those two things exactly?
Well, so I don't know if I can explain this well.
Oh, okay.
So
we can save it.
Yeah. The hunger hormones would be like leptin and ghrelin. So there is two hunger hormones that basically make you hungry and or make you full.
Okay.
And so those ones can be affected in numerous different ways. But then there's also the satiety aspect of it. And satiety, in my mind, I look at satiety as you're satisfied and not needing something more. And that's usually a measure of like you ate enough, but also that you ate enough nutrients. And that's one of the things that really stood out for me in the Dorito Effect book that I mentioned, is that when your brain is tasting things, when your tongue is tasting things, it's interacting with the brain and telling the brain to expect certain things. And then the food gets into the gut, and the gut now sends a signal to the brain about what it actually got. And that can be disconnected, and that happens a lot with processed food, especially with processed flavorings.
And Doritos.
The Doritos, yeah.
So full of flavor.
The Doritos. I mean, highly recommend the book. It's really interesting how they've created all these flavors. Like the Dorito, I think the nacho flavor of Dorito was one of the first foods that was really like not the right food. It was a tortilla chip that tastes like nachos, and that's why they named the book that, because it was one of the first to do that. But he talks about different experiments that they've done, especially in like animals, where they've given animals, you know, pre-made meals, and then they've also given the animal, you know, different group of animals, a selection of the same kind of foods, but all separately. And they'll watch how they interact with those, and how they develop and grow, and how much weight they gain, and all these kinds of things. And they actually found that the animals that were able to pick and choose their own selection of foods, even though they had a dietitian create the perfect meal plan for these animals, the animals that actually got to pick and choose, it changes throughout the day to day what nutrients they actually needed, and how they learn that, I don't know. But they would pick different foods, mostly from what the researchers, you know, understood was based on their nutrient requirements at that time. And there was this interaction that was happening with the brain and the gut about what it was eating. And those things can get hijacked when you start putting artificial flavorings in the mouth, because the brain thinks that it's getting this certain thing, but the gut doesn't register it when it gets down there.
Right.
So you end up with this loop where you can't, your brain is like, I didn't get that, so then I want more. And so you can end up overeating things, thinking that you're still trying to satisfy that thing that the gut hasn't registered yet. And then that can mess you up for other foods too, because you don't, then all of a sudden that sends up, that disrupts the signaling between the gut and the brain, and you end up not being able to you know, taste good foods even. So now those foods don't hit the brain the same way as they should have if they're unadulterated. And then your brain doesn't maybe think that those taste good. And that's where you can get some acquired tastes, you know, things over time that the body's like, oh, I'm starting to learn that I get these certain nutrients or this effect from this food, and that is something that is valuable to me. So people start eating liver and they're like, oh my God, I can't eat this. And then over time it grows on them and they're like, oh, you know what? I just feel amazing when I have this. I crave it now. But that took time because the brain and the gut had to start reconnecting how those nutrients were associated with the taste that the mouth was getting.
So it was a spoiled child that just got all this stuff and he's rambunctious and you can't control him. So you got to reimagine that kid and then fix it so that he's like, oh, wait, this is really good if I do things properly or whatever.
Yeah, and you got to experiment with the kids and figure out, you know, how you can get them to acquire that taste, you know, and that can happen over time. And then when they don't get it, then it feels like there's something missing.
Yeah.
And that's when you start looking for
How long does it take to, like, switch something like that if you've been Doritoed?
You know, I can't remember if they mentioned this in the book or not. In my mind, what sticks in my head is like 7 days, 14 days. Like, it's not very long. It's not very long at all to sort of change, to acquire a taste or to change those taste buds. Now, if you keep bombarding yourself with those, you know, artificial strong flavors that are hitting the brain and the tongue and, you know, just right, then you might not fix that issue. Your brain's still overwhelmed by the amazing flavors that are, you know, we can create now. They can make, you know, we have protein bars that were like a birthday cake flavor, you know, so you're eating a protein bar, but your brain's like, I'm eating birthday cake.
Yeah.
You know, that's the flavors that are hitting it. And that interaction is that, but it's not actually that food. And so that's can mess up your relationship to the nutrients in food and also what real food tastes like.
So maybe people should just go back to like beef and chicken with butter and
Well, salt, and then and we pepper, go back to the and then single ingredient foods, right?
Bring it down to the baseline and then you can start from there again.
Yeah.
For a week too.
And maybe that's why, you know, people do these cleanses and things that yeah. kind of do it as a reset. You know, they need those things because they need to eliminate all this, you know, junk food for a period of time and reset their system. And, I mean, and they come out of it going, oh, yeah, I feel amazing. And then, you know, things change, you know, how yeah. you taste things change and how you digest things change. And then all of a sudden that processed food maybe doesn't feel as good as it used to yeah. Or taste as good as it used to. But this other nutrient dense food does.
And 7-14 days isn't that long. Like most people can do things for, you know, dig deep and just be like, I'm just going to do this. You don't have to be like, I'm going to do this and then I'm going to change my whole life. You can just be like 7 days.
Yeah.
And then I'll reassess and yeah. then I'll go from there.
Yeah.
Cool. Wow. So that went into some detailed stuff. So going back to the food group and the pyramid and stuff, it sounds like your biggest gripe with it is that it's not focused on nutrient dense stuff. And if you focus what you're putting into your body on what nutrients am I getting, then that'll transform or it might be different than their guidelines here. And it might be different for different people, right? Like we were talking in the first one about how do you feel? What makes you feel a certain way? So mm-hmm. different foods might be.
Yeah, and I don't want to make it out like you need to go learn what each food's nutrient content right. is. But there's kind of these categories that we can think about.
Okay.
And so the most nutrient dense food is going to be, this is based on, I believe, Ty Beal's work. And who? The most Ty Beal, I believe is his name.
Beal?
Yeah, yeah. He did a bunch of analysis of different foods,
okay.
and specifically focused on some of the most nutrient deficiencies that humans experience across the world.
Okay,
which was an interesting way to focus it because obviously those are problematic foods or nutrients that is chronically deficient in a population, and so you know if we prioritize some of these foods, then hopefully we can correct some of those deficiencies. But, you know, overall, nutrient density-wise, and there's so many different ways to calculate nutrient density, and that's one of the challenges. Because you could also look at, like, some people are going to compare it, like, the amount of vitamins and minerals versus calories. But then there's more nuance than that because you can only eat so much of that. So, like, you know, if I said, hey, you got to eat, you know, 4 cups of carrots a day to get this nutrient, you know, how realistic is that yeah. for you? You're going to be able to eat really 4 cups, you know, but if I said you need to eat 1 ounce of liver every day,
yeah.
you know, to get enough of whatever nutrient, it's 1 ounce.
Yeah.
I hope you could accomplish that.
I like liver,
if you're open
so.
To liver. Yeah. Yeah. And so there is some nuance there. Anyways, but he kind of categorizes things as the most nutrient dense thing, foods would be your, he calls them bivalves. So that'd be like your shellfish, your oysters, your clams. And that would be, also organ meats. So your liver, your heart, your kidney. And then after that, you're going to have, some green leafy vegetables that are up there and they're up there, you know, not necessarily that they're so nutrient packed, like, say a liver or a shellfish would be. But because their calorie content is quite low mm-hmm. compared to the amount of nutrients that you
oh,
get.
I see.
So you don't actually have to, the quantity that you're eating is calorically very low.
Mm.
So you can get a lot of nutrients that way, but that can still be limited because you can only eat so much kale and so on
right.
and so forth. And then you're going to have things like pork and beef, eggs, there's going to be nuts and seeds up there, there's going to be certain fruits up there, and that's what your most nutrient dense foods are, you know, and dairy products of course are going to be, you know, not at the top tier, they're probably going to be, you know, a little bit further down the list, but definitely more than, you know, mm-hmm. say grains or
right.
Would be. And then, you know, you also got to think about one of the unique things that he did is the group that he was working with did is they also looked at the bioavailability of foods, and that's something that can get lost a little bit as well, where, you know, spinach has iron in it, but that iron is locked up in a pretty tight matrix in that food, and it's not always going to be easy for us to extract that iron out of that compared to iron in, say, something like red meat, which is going to be very easy for our body to absorb. So he did take into account some of those factors as well, which is important because if you don't absorb it or you can't digest it, there's right. what's it's not really nutritious for you.
Yeah.
So
that makes sense.
Yeah. So that's where I'm looking at is this kind of like tier of things. If you're going to prioritize things, it's going to be shellfish, and it's going to be organ meats. It's going to be green leafy vegetables. It's going to be muscle meat. It's going to be eggs. It's going to be fish. You know, small fish like sardines and things like that. And then, you know, fruit and what else would it be after that? Dairy products.
Wow. Okay. Well, it sounds like you can make a new pyramid with that.
There probably isn't someone.
Yeah. Did he make one?
That would be interesting. I don't know if he did. Yeah. I don't know. I'll have to look him up. Yeah.
Cool. All right. Well, we better end there because this cookie's turned into a... We were on a date.
Oh, we got into some off topic.
It's all on topic. It's just hard not to, because there's so much to it. Like, I can ask a simple question, and this is why I've always wanted to record you when we're talking, because I can ask a simple question, and it brings up five things that aren't simple that I never thought were related.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah, like when I asked about oatmeal, is oatmeal bad or good for you? And you're like, well, hold on a sec. You have to think of it this way. So it's really great because it gets you thinking differently. And I hope when people listen to this, they start, they don't have to take things verbatim necessarily, but just start thinking more mm-hmm. about what they're doing. Like, if nothing more, when you go into a grocery store and read the labels, it's you're stopping and reading a label.
Yeah.
And you're thinking about what you're picking up and maybe buying. And then you really, it just slows you down.
Right? Yeah. And, I wish they'd, like you said, they'd done the label thing. You know, you could teach people how to read a label.
Yeah.
Of course, it's more nuanced than just reading the labels now, too, because now we've added foods to low-nutrient foods. We've fortified them. And so that's the other interesting thing. Like, we have grains as our base. I know, I can't help myself. So this is bear with me. We have the grains at the base of the pyramid, and the interesting thing is grains are so nutrient poor, at least the processing of them takes out so many of the nutrients in them that we have to fortify them after production. We need to add certain vitamins and minerals back into them because they are so devoid of nutrients that we cause deficiencies in nutrients when we didn't do that. So we add B vitamins back to bread, or we add certain minerals back like iron to cereals and things like that. Maybe not the best iron, you know, it's probably not very well absorbed, and for some people it might even cause some problems, but that's how nutrient poor those foods are that we found that we needed to add, you know, almost a multivitamin to it to make it nutritious again.
So when you see things now, it says with this, mm-hmm. it's not like it, because as a consumer, you'd look at it and go, oh, I'm getting this now also with this, but it's more saying that this ad doesn't have anything.
Yeah.
So we tried to put something good in it.
Yeah. And then you got to find that on the label too. So like, you know, sometimes it's, you know, when they give you that nutrition panel and you have, you know, a certain amount of iron or B vitamins or calcium or something like that, they don't differentiate whether that was naturally occurring in that product or if that was added after. So like you'll get some of these plant-based milks and they'll say more calcium than milk.
Mm.
And it's like, well, that food doesn't actually have calcium, abundance of calcium in it. They've added calcium to it to make it more calcium than they've added calcium carbonate to it, which is how you make almond milk white or oat milk white, is you add calcium carbonate to it. And then they can say, oh, they have this much calcium in it. But all they did was added some calcium carbonate to it to give it higher amounts. It doesn't naturally, almonds and oats don't naturally have more calcium than milk. It's from this fortification that happens in the production process that gives it more calcium than milk, but really you're just supplementing with calcium and maybe not the best form of calcium, just something that they are willing to put in there.
So unless you dig into this, you wouldn't know that. So then you're getting marketing is kind of redirecting your education and teaching you things that you don't know you're learning that are wrong. Like almond milk has calcium.
Yeah. I mean, it's not wrong. It has it in processed that food.
Yeah.
That they've made. But if you made your own almond milk, it's not going to have that.
But if you go around thinking like, oh, almond milk has lots of calcium.
Yeah.
Like then you it's not true. So you've
But it's this. Also not wrong. Really though, it's also not wrong. because it is in there.
It's in that form.
It's in that product.
That product. That, right.
They're not lying. It's in there.
Right. But if almond milk, natural almond milk, is that how I got to say it? You're very...
Say homemade almond milk.
Homemade almond milk.
Okay. If you took almonds and you pureed them with some water and you put them through a cheesecloth and you squeeze out all the milk, the for lack of a better term, that's from that into a container and you have your own homemade almond milk, it's not going to have very much calcium in it.
Right. Okay.
Not like the store-bought stuff would. And definitely so you can't, not as much as milk would.
Right. Naturally. You can't translate things like that. Like the almond milk has calcium to almonds have calcium.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. I had like two other questions when you were going there, but they are gone, which is probably good because we can go forever here.
Yeah.
That's great.
Yeah.
All right. Cool. So basic is just kind of focus on some nutrients. And I guess it goes back to the same thing like supplements. Like what are you deficient in? Maybe you should focus on that for your nutrition as well.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't see how you could go wrong focusing on nutrient density.
Right.
I just don't see how if you're prioritizing the most nutrient dense foods, I'm sorry, I'm going to go on another tangent, but it also matters like where that food came from, the soil it's grown. So there's a lot of nuances with nutrient density, how long it's been in storage for. You know, I read an interesting article about broccoli and the amount of folate that's in broccoli. Folate's a B vitamin, and they measured the amount that they had after picking it fresh, and then I believe it dropped by 50% after 24 hours of storage.
What?
And so, like, when you're buying broccoli from the grocery store, how long and since that, you know, and broccoli's not a, you know, that's going to be, you know, a good food for a lot of people, but how long ago was that picked and how much is left in it now?
Does it go to 50 and then stay at 50 or does it go to 50, 25 to nothing?
That is a great question. I don't know. I can hypothesize that it diminishes more over time.
You would think so.
I would think so, but I don't know for sure. That always stuck in my mind of, you know, and that's where I've come from, where I eat, you know, as much as I can. My produce is local in season. And that's because when you're comparing nutrient densities of produce specifically, the more local fresh you have, the more nutrient dense it's going to be. And so you get more vitamins and minerals from that. Plus, hopefully, you know, you're a farmer and there's, you know, more downstream effects of shopping local and seasonally and all that. But it's
crazy.
It came originally, you know, my thought process was, man, if I'm trying to get these foods that have grown in California and then shipped here, what am I getting once it's here?
So that's that problem where people are always like, I'm trying to eat healthy. I am eating healthy. I'm eating all these the proper things. I'm eating so healthy, like all these vegetables. But like it might just be empty or close to empty or whatever, like depending on when and where. And immediately I thought, oh, great. So if I have broccoli, I got triple my portion to get the B.
Yeah. Or just, you know, pay attention to that. Yeah. And this is why it's so hard for people to figure out, you know, what is the healthy diet and what they should be eating, because it's so complicated.
Yeah.
You know, there's all these little things. And so, you know, I hesitate to mention all that stuff because I don't want someone to all of a sudden get so overwhelmed with the oh my God, I got to eat, you know, nutrient dense, you know, I got to think about nutrient density. I got to think about how long this thing has been picked and how long it's been stored. And do I need to eat local? And, you know, how do I, you know, now make my plate? I'm not really supposed to eat grains, but, you know, it's all these things. And so that's where it's like, when you can think about just like we talked about in the first one, is just start with something that you can do, you know, you can do 90% of the time. And go with that. And then that builds over time to something more. So if you want to just forget about how long something is picked for, you're going from eating fast food to eating broccoli, that's a step in the right direction. Right. Who cares if it's from California?
Right.
you know, that we're looking for small steps over time,
right?
More so than trying to make this dramatic change. Very few people are going to be able to make that dramatic change and stick with it long term. So, you know, maybe that means maybe I'll start eating a little bit more shellfish, or maybe I'm going to look at, you know, maybe I'm going to try liver for the first time, or maybe I'm going to, you know, try going to a farm. Whatever that thing is that they can do 90% of the time, that small change that they could in the right direction that they can they can make, that they can adhere to 90% of the time, that's the step you go with, and you forget about it, you know, all the stuff I said so far.
Well, it's kind of like I've thought with, you said once about testosterone, the best thing you can do is eat a pound of red meat a day. Now with it, we won't get into all that right now, but what I thought about was that I'm like, that's expensive if I'm getting like good quality local meat. But I guess, is bad pound a day meat still better than not pound a day meat?
Probably.
Okay. So that's like
depending
that one
on the
step,
meat,
right?
You know, then you got to look at like what farming practices,
right,
change the food the most.
Right.
And from my perspective, the herbivores, the grass eaters, are the ones that get adulterated the least. Mm-hmm. And so those are the ones that I'm most confident in saying, if you want to go eat grocery store beef,
yeah,
that's probably okay.
Yeah.
That's probably not going to be that's a step in the right direction. Yeah. Chicken can get a little bit more nuanced, you know, fish versus wild fish, yeah, you know, that can get a little more nuanced. Pork can be a little bit more nuanced because unfortunately we can farm these animals in really horrendous
right
conditions and with really horrendous feeds, right, and you can't get away with as much with the grass eaters.
Okay.
And so you end up with more confidence that food is going to be more nutritious.
Right.
But then I just made things more complicated,
yeah,
because I just threw in, you know.
Right. But if you take that first step, yeah. And go like, okay, now I'm doing this. And then once you get used to doing that, then you go, why am I eating this crappy version of it? And then you want to take that next step then it being more expensive is like, well, it's not expensive. It's just good. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So then you
just don't
buy that beer that week.
Totally. Yeah. Or maybe don't eat as much.
Yeah.
You know, maybe you don't need to eat that huge amount,
yeah,
because it's more nutrient dense, you know, and maybe we don't notice that in beef. I don't think that there's research showing that the nutrient density of beef changes massively when you go from like a, you know, 100% grass fed from a conventional one. I'm sure there's also nuance there because then you get into regenerative agriculture, and don't know if they've actually measured them. And Joel Salatin and Will Harris from White Oak Pastures would definitely probably argue with you that theirs is going to be more nutrient dense.
Yeah, yeah.
But as a whole, but when you look at, you know, eggs and chicken and
yeah,
pork, there's a little bit more changes that happen when you feed them their inappropriate diet.
So you'd say if you're going to spend your money, spend it on that stuff first.
Spend it on that stuff first.
Okay.
Yeah. Hmm. Yeah.
Okay. We better stop here.
Yeah.
That was awesome.
Solid hour.
That was awesome. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah. Okay. Well, we will, we'll do this again, and we're going to start. Oh, hell, I don't know what's going to be next. We'll figure it out.
We'll figure it out.
Okay.
We'll do it
again.
Thank
you, man. That was awesome.
Yeah.
Cool.